frame of argument in our last case, 08-8525, United States against McDonald. Mr. Zasitarski, is that pretty close?
That's it, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, man.
Yeah, why don't you say it for me?
Zasitarski.
Okay.
Good morning.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Joe Zasitarski. I represent the appellant in this case, Jeffrey McDonald. McDonald filed a Section 2255 motion in the district court in January of 2006. In that motion, he alleged constitutional claims. He alleged that he was convicted at trial in violation of his constitutional rights based upon an affidavit, largely, from a retired...
What constitutional right was it?
The constitutional right, Your Honor, was the due process in that he alleged the Deputy United States Marshal in the affidavit averred under oath that one of the prosecutors in the case, Mr. Blackburn, had threatened the key defense witness, she had said something different to the prosecutor in their meeting the day before. So that was alleged in the affidavit underlying the 2255 motion that was filed in January of 2006. Shortly thereafter, DNA results were returned from DNA testing that had been ordered by this court some 10 years earlier, 9.5 years earlier, in 1997. When those results were returned, McDonald, through his lawyers, moved to add a predicate to his motion and also asked that it be considered in the motion as a whole. And in those DNA results, McDonald alleged that the results showed, key to this appeal and key to his claim of actual innocence, that underneath the fingernail of one of his daughters who was killed was a hair among the fingernail scrapings. And that hair, when it was subjected to DNA testing, did not match McDonald, any member of the McDonald family, Helena Stokely, Greg Mitchell, Helena Stokely's boyfriend. Those exemplars were also tested. That is, some stranger to the house. Furthermore, in a position where there was testimony at trial that this young girl had struggled with her attackers. The district court denied the motion under the 2244 gatekeeping standard. And in applying that standard, the district court explicitly refused to consider a number of pieces of evidence, including that DNA evidence. The district court, in its order, explicitly said that it was not going to consider that evidence, explicitly said that it was not going to consider evidence in connection with earlier habeas petition that had been filed by McDonald. And in doing that, it did it at the government's urging. And in doing so, the district court would submit error in this case. The district court, when it did this, the relevant section obviously is 2244, which states that the successor 2255 petition must be dismissed unless, quote, the facts underlying the claim, if proven and viewed in light of the evidence as a whole, would be sufficient to establish by clear and convincing evidence that, but for the constitutional error, no reasonable fact finder would have found the applicant guilty of the underlying offense. The phrase there being, quote, in light of the evidence as a whole.
Now what do you think that means?
Your Honor, I submit that that means all of the record evidence at the time that the court is considering that petition, whether it's trial, it's submitted in connection with some other habeas petition, or whether it's evidence submitted in connection with this 2255 motion. And that is in line with the plain meaning of the statute, number one.
But how about the rules of evidence? Do they have any applicability?
Well, Your Honor, the rules of evidence, according to the one case that we've cited, the case from the Lott case from the District Court in Ohio, which was affirmed by the Sixth Circuit, the rules of evidence do not have any applicability to that consideration. In the Lott case, the district court considered evidence that was submitted by the 2255 petitioner supporting his innocence and also considered a confession by that defendant which had been suppressed at the trial, but the court considered it in looking at the innocence gateway issue, which really gets to the issue behind this 2244 standard, which we've cited in our brief, the treatise, which says 2244 basically incorporates the previous Schlupp innocence inquiry when you're looking at this gatekeeping issue. And there, obviously, what they're looking at is innocence. The court considers all of the evidence as a whole.
So you'd say inadmissible evidence is part of this evidence as a whole?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the Lott case, the court...
And these affidavits that you have, like from Mr. Britt and all these other folks...
Yes, sir.
Ms. Stokely's mother, all
yes,
that, you say that can be considered?
That can be considered, yes, sir.
Plus the trial record?
Yes, sir. Plus the evidence that was submitted in connection with the earlier habeas petition filed by Mr. McDonald.
Plus the DNA stuff?
Correct. All of which the court explicitly said it was not going to consider.
What happened to that DNA order from 1997? This court issued an order in 1997 authorizing the DNA examinations. And did you say it was 9 or 10 years before the results came in? Why that delay?
Well, Your Honor, it's my understanding, and I did not...
Were you involved in it?
I was not, Your Honor. I've become involved in this case on the appeal of this order only.
You were in 10th grade when that happened.
I think that's about right, Your Honor. And when the events underlying this case occurred, I was a year old. But in any event, my understanding is that there was a lot of wrangling back and forth about who would do the testing, what would be subjected
wrangling
to
wrangling back
testing.
And forth between the lawyers?
Between the lawyers, correct.
How about the court? Did anybody make any motions to the court or anything
it's
like that?
It's my understanding that there were times that they were before the court to determine the scope of the testing, what would be tested, and where the testing would take place. Yes, sir.
But nobody could agree?
It's my understanding that eventually it got worked out, but that explains why it took 10 years for it to occur.
Well, that just jumps out as a... You know, long time to...
I agree wholeheartedly, Your Honor. I agree wholeheartedly. And obviously, from my client's perspective in this case, he would have been in a whole lot better position before this court, before the district court, certainly, if those results had come back just 6 months earlier, rather than when they did, just about shortly after he filed this petition. In connection with those results, Your Honor, there is one point I do want to make that I think is vitally important to the consideration of those results. In the motions that the government has filed this past week, in their reply that was filed last week, the government took the position that there is no evidence in the record that the hair was part of the fingernail scrapings, that is Army CID exhibit, I believe it's D-237. That there was no evidence that a hair was part of those fingernail scrapings.
Is that the hair that you just talked about?
That's the hair we're talking about, Your Honor. Correct. And that's why I think it's vitally important. And what I would do, Your Honor, is I would point first to the Joint Appendix, page 1133, which is the lab report, the AFIP report, where it says...
AFIP is the Air Force Institute of Technology?
Armed Forces, Your Honor.
Armed Forces Institute.
Where they refer to CID Exhibit D-293, it becomes their Exhibit 91A, and it says hair. So the report itself, I'd submit, says it's hair. The lab tech notes, which are at page 1244 of the Joint Appendix, as to 91A, which is D-237, says, quote, one human hair with root but no tissue. And to the extent the court has any question about this issue, I'd ask to submit a supplemental pleadings with the court, because there was a filing by the government in 1999 relating to this DNA testing issue where they submitted a number of pictures of what was going to be tested. And within that exhibit, there's actually a picture of 91A that shows a hair. I submit that to accept the government's argument that there's no evidence that D-237 contains a hair in the fingernail scrapings is to say that the government apparently doesn't believe in the veracity of its own evidence, because this is the government's evidence. This wasn't the defendant's evidence. This has been in the custody of the government. We submit there's no question that a hair was in those fingernail scrapings, and that hair does not match McDonald. Vitally important evidence of innocence in this case. Now, the government, in their pleadings, has said that the evidence as a whole in this inquiry does not include the DNA, does not include the evidence in support of the habeas petition, and apparently does not include many other things, only things that a PFA were granted for by this court.
They say it only includes what, the Brit stuff?
The Brit stuff, yes, sir.
So that's where you all, one place you differ is on the definition of this evidence as a whole.
Absolutely.
You all are diametrically opposed. Right?
Absolutely.
Evidence of a whole seems to me to be, those are all words we can understand, and that seems to me to support your argument, but how do you square that broad reading of evidence of a whole with the fact that we are here on what Congress and Supreme Court have clearly said is very limited review in successive habeas petitions? I mean, isn't it that sort of an end around all that if what you're saying is true?
Well, Your Honor, I would say it's not, because it goes back to the Schlupp standard from which 2244 was derived, where before the AEDPA was enacted in 96, I believe, the Schlupp standard applied, where you had to show evidence of actual innocence to get past.
Yeah, but now we do have AEDPA its glory.
We do, Your Honor. And AEDPA enacted this phrase, evidence as a whole. There's nothing in the legislature.
But there's also all kinds of bars in AEDPA about if you haven't raised an argument before, you don't get to raise it now. You know, there are all kinds of signals to us that our review is to get more and more limited, not to expand in this great bubble of looking at all past evidence if you can come up with some new evidence now.
Well, Your Honor, I think that those bars deal with claims.
You're saying this is reversed when it's an innocence claim?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're saying that whole thing is reversed when it's an innocence claim?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that those other bars in the statute all deal with claims under 2255, habeas claims, not evidence submitted in support of a habeas claim. That's the key distinction that I would stress to this court.
But you have to have a habeas claim, and your habeas claim is actual innocence. So you get back to what Judge King is saying.
Well, Your Honor.
That when you have an actual innocence claim, you say that all of the measures that Congress has put in the law and that the Supreme Court has applauded and enforced right and left go out the window, and the whole record of the case is reopened, and we look at every piece of evidence that has not only been admitted or considered at trial, but any evidence anywhere, anyhow.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that in considering whether the constitutional claims, here the claims based on the Brit affidavit, survive the 2244 gatekeeping standard, we consider the evidence as a whole, all of the evidence, in considering whether the facts underlying the claim, if proven and viewed in light of the evidence as a whole, would be sufficient to establish by clear and convincing evidence that but for constitutional error, no reasonable fact finder would find the applicant guilty.
Okay, tell me what you think the constitutional claim is here and where it's alleged, the constitutional claim.
Here, the constitutional claim, Your Honor, is in Deputy United States Marshal Britt's affidavit and in the motion and memo incorporating that AUSA Blackburn, in a meeting with Helena Stokely, the key defense witness, threatened her with indicting her for murder if she testified in court that she was present in the home, the McDonald home, on the night of the murder.
Okay, and so what's the constitutional claim?
The constitutional
claim is
the
facts.
Is the, under this court's decision in Golding, that the prosecutor has threatened a defense witness into not testifying because the next day she claimed she couldn't remember the four-hour period during which the murders occurred.
So under what amendment is this?
This would be due process under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, Your Honor. This court's holding in Golding specifically addresses this.
So this is your constitutional claim?
Yes.
So due process, Fifth, Fourteenth Amendment.
That's one, Your Honor. And the second
this
is...
This would be the Fifth Amendment here because it's a federal prosecution.
Correct, yes.
And what about the DNA stuff? Is that a separate claim?
Well, we have asked that the DNA stuff be considered a separate claim, and that claim would have to be an actual innocence claim itself.
And that would be under the Eighth Amendment?
Yes.
Well, was that the basis on which you originally asked, or is this new part of new evidence?
Well, Your Honor, and I think that's where this sort of ties in a
when
very...
When we granted the certificate of appealability, was that part of what you were bringing to the court?
What I was bringing to the court in certificate of appealability as to the DNA was specifically as to judging the, dismissing the complaint on the 2244 standard. Not whether DNA could stand alone or not stand alone, that it needed to be considered part of the evidence as a whole. I think there's a whole other issue out there, which is that this court has ordered that that DNA testing take place. But the district court expressly refused to consider it. This court ordered that it take place and that the results be...
Well, it has taken place now,
And they were reported to the court. But the district court refused to consider those results. And I think that that's an issue that plays into this somehow as well. I see my time is up, and I've saved some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is John DePue, and unfortunately, I was not 1 year old when this case began. This marks the fourth occasion during a period of almost 30 years that I have appeared before Your Honors in this particular proceeding. Seated at counsel table with me is Mr. Brian Murtaugh, who has been involved in this case for almost 38 years now. First as an attorney for the Army CID Command when he was an Army judge advocate, and then as one of the prosecutors in this case. Also seated at counsel table with me is John Bruce, the first assistant U.S. attorney who was our co-counsel. Before addressing the main event here, the statutory construction issue, I'd like to first apologize to this court for not addressing in a more timely manner what we think to be a very substantial jurisdictional issue here. That under Section 2253C2, this court must certify a constitutional claim as the subject of a COA, a certificate of appealability. That was not done here. Now, we don't maintain that the court can never consider under a COA a non-constitutional claim, but we believe that in the wake of Slack versus McDaniel, it must at the least have some linkage to a constitutional claim. There is no linkage here.
You mean a linkage that's expressed in writing in the paper?
Not necessarily. Well, I think you have to identify a constitutional claim.
The court has to. Go ahead.
I think you first have to identify the constitutional claim. Mm-hmm. Second, if you have a statutory claim, there must be a linkage either explicit or implicit to the constitutional claim, such as in Slack versus McDaniel, where the district court refused to entertain the constitutional claim because of a procedural barrier. That plainly was not the case here. Judge Fox entertained the constitutional claim here and rejected it on very fact-specific grounds. He found that what Mr. Britt allegedly recalled simply could not happen in the manner in which it was recalled because it was inconsistent with the defense counsel's own representations as to what Ms. Stokely had told him.
I thought he said he would accept what Britt said as true.
No, he said he would accept what Britt said as a true representation of his recollection.
Well, that's about all any witness could do.
Right. But then he said...
Every witness that testifies that way is telling the
truth. That's correct, Your Honor. But then he said, when I juxtapose this against the trial record, the two are inconsistent because the defense attorney himself represented that Stokely had no recollection. So there is no predicate jurisdiction.
I thought Britt was talking about what Stokely told Blackburn the day before.
Britt made several representations.
No, but first, the one thing he was talking about was what Britt told Blackburn. The defense attorney wasn't present then. The defense attorney wasn't present
then.
Stokely talked to Blackburn.
That's correct. But immediately before that.
No, but Britt said that Stokely told Blackburn whatever the story was, and Blackburn said, if that's what you testify to, I'll indict you for murder.
Yes, Your Honor. That was Mr. Britt's affidavit.
That's what Britt said in his affidavit.
But
then Blackburn said something different to the judge the next day, according to somebody.
Yes, but what Judge Fox hung his hat on
was what the defense lawyer said he was told, but Britt was talking about what the prosecutor was told.
Right. So my point is...
Those are two different things.
Yeah, my point is here that... Judge Fox's analysis here was not predicated upon the statutory issues that are present here, but rather upon his own assessment of the record. That's what caused him to reject this. Therefore, there's no jurisdiction under 2253C2. The second threshold matter that I'd like to discuss before I get into the main event here is the representation that the bloody scrapings from Kristen McDonald's left-hand fingernail contained an unidentified hair. As my opponent has told you, very early on in these proceedings, the Army CID command labeled this item as D-237. It labeled the McDonald's pajama top as item D-210. Two forensic examiners, Mr. Dillard Browning, a hair and fiber expert, and a CID command chemist, both analyzed these scrapings. Mr. Browning's report appears in the record at page 1150. It does not mention the presence of hair. It does mention the presence of Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top. Similarly, the serologist also examined the same exhibit, made no mention of hair, and what I think is the most telling is Joint Appendix page 1183, which is a combined compilation of the findings of both examiners. There is a chart on page 1183 that has a space for the presence of hair. That chart is blank. It does, however, reflect finding hairs from or fibers from Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top. In short, this hair business is nothing more than the same sort of household debris that this court dubbed specious evidence when I was here before in 1992. But this case isn't about hair and fibers. What it's about is a question of statutory construction.
Okay.
Whether.
So what does evidence as
a whole? I believe that the statute does not in its terms define it. So I would invite the court's attention to two sources for the definition of that term. First, the Supreme Court's decision in Schlupp versus Dillo, from which the language is evidently and obviously lifted. The Schlupp decision identifies three types of evidence as newly discovered as the evidence as a whole. One, evidence that was admitted at trial, and that's an easy one. Two, evidence that was excluded at trial. And here that would be Helen Stokely's hearsay testimony that Judge Dupree excluded. And three, evidence creditably determined to have been newly discovered. That is, the newly discovered evidence that is at issue. It certainly cannot embrace evidence that a prior habeas court held was not newly discovered, which is what the defendant is essentially asking you to do here. The second source of definition is one of the most fundamental canons of statutory construction that we have. That in looking at a word or phrase in a statute, you can't consider the phrase or word in isolation, but rather you must look at it in the context of the statute in its entirety. Here, that's ADEPA. And in such a manner as to give every word and phrase in the statute a meaning. The net result of the defendant's construction of this statute would be to excise from the provisions of the statute, one, the requirement that the defendant first must obtain a pre-filing application from this court under section 2255H. And that relates to the PFA analysis as well, or to the DNA analysis as well as to the statement of Helena Stokely's mother. Second, that it cannot consider claims that are time barred under section 2255F4. That includes the statements of the three individuals who allegedly heard Greg Mitchell indicate he may have been a participant in this crime. That evidence was known to the defendant as early as 1984. And third, it cannot consider claims that were previously litigated. And that relates to evidence relating to hair and fiber testing that was before Judge Dupree back in 1989, and I was here telling your predecessors about back in 1991. The net result of the defendant's construction of that statute would be to excise from the fabric of the statute these three important limitations that Congress put in that statute expressly to preclude repetitive, redundant, habeas submissions. Now, we're not maintaining that the DNA testing can never be considered in this case. As Judge Fox pointed out to the defendant, all you have to do is go to the Court of Appeals and file a motion for a free filing application. This is a separate claim. You're not barred from reaching it. You simply must follow the rules. And for some tactical reason unknown to us, the defendant chose not to follow the rules in this case. Now, he still may come to this court with a pre-filing application and may ask you to approve it. And we would probably oppose it under those circumstances, but the door is still not closed to him from doing so. The second category of issues, and the second rule that Judge Fox applied here, involved untimely petitions for habeas relief. As I indicated earlier, the defendant's pre-filing application involving Judge Britt's allegations was accompanied by three affidavits indicating that the affiance had heard Greg Mitchell assert that from time to time in the late 1970s and in the early 1980s, he had indicated participation in the crime. But as we pointed out in some detail in our brief, these precise allegations were known to the defense first in a 1984 petition they submitted, appending to them the affidavit of one of these affiants, again in 1989, and what they submitted to this court was dated 2005. It was the same petition, but repackaged apparently to make it appear that the defendant learned about this stuff for the first time in 1985. Simply not true. And again, if the court were to permit this submission, it would have the net effect of excising from the statute the requirements of 2255 HF4. The third category involves section 2244B1 that precludes relitigation of previously litigated claims in this court. Now, in the Weinstock decision, this court pretermitted the question whether 2244B1 applies to federal habeas. Since the Weinstock decision, five circuits have held that it did, and the defendant concedes that it did, in fact, in footnote 4 of his reply brief. What is primarily at issue here, although the defendant doesn't identify it as such, are two items. Once again, the affidavits of Greg Mitchell, which Judge Britt twice rejected and this court twice affirmed. Second, he relitigates or attempts to relitigate in paragraphs 42 and 43 of his motion to enhance the record allegations that the government concealed the presence of unmatched wool fibers on a club that was found at the household and was found to have been a murder weapon. Well, these precise claims were litigated before Judge Dupree, called the stuff household debris. This court called it specious evidence. My question is, how many bites of the apple does this defendant get on the same claim? He raises for the first time in his brief the allegation that the government suborned perjury, essentially, with respect to this evidence, that while it had two of its forensic evidence experts testify that certain blue-colored threads on the club murder weapon were hairs from Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top, that in reality it was later identified that the hairs were, in fact, black wool fibers.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it seems to me that there's a sort of a disconnect here in that the only thing that is before us, aside from jurisdiction, is this gatekeeping thing.
Right.
We're not going to the merits yet.
Right.
And it seems to me that many of your arguments are what you would make to the district court, and then maybe to us for the 15th time, about the merits. But if you get back to the language in the statute that, you know, talks about evidence as a whole, and then you directed us to Schlupp, which you say is the origin, and I have no reason to doubt you on that, of that language, I don't, I have a hard time computing how you don't look at all of the evidence. I mean, the Supreme Court expressly told us you look at evidence that wasn't admitted.
Right, Your Honor.
I think that inadmissible evidence is to be considered.
Right.
So that it strikes me that that kind of opens the field for evidence as a whole, all the evidence.
Again, the term isn't self-explanatory, and I think the way you
but
have
But you
to,
directed us to Schlupp, and I was back and trying to scan it and listen to you at the same time, so I thought maybe you could help me.
What we're talking about under Schlupp as newly discovered evidence is
yeah, but is, they say that they don't talk just about that.
Well, they talk about two other categories. Evidence that was admitted.
But it doesn't say anything about the exception that you say. You look at Schlupp and you say, and this is the only kind of evidence. But that's not what the Supreme Court said. It was an inclusive range that they were telling
us.
They didn't say, by the way, this means that X, Y, and Z are not evidence.
I think Schlupp's the first place you look to look at the categories. And I think the second place you have to look
at the statute.
Is the statute.
The plain language of the statute.
Right, and the statute contains some very, very significant limitations and exceptions.
Which statute are you talking about?
Section 2255 and Section 2244. The court it makes
but it also it, says evidence of the whole.
It makes yes, it makes it, it but you have, as I said earlier, you have to construe that language in the context of the rest of the statute.
Of the and, rest of that
pardon?
Of the rest of that subsection.
Well I think
would be sufficient to establish by clear and convincing evidence that no reasonable fact finder would have found the movement guilty of the offense.
Yeah, what's
is that what you're talking about? You weigh the evidence as a whole.
Yeah.
With the newly discovered evidence, or with the facts underlying the claim, and decide whether by clear and convincing evidence, no reasonable fact finder would have found the movement guilty.
And our inquiry
and how could you make a reasonable assessment of what a reasonable fact finder would do if you didn't take a broad view of the evidence as a whole?
Well, I'm willing to take a broad view of the evidence as a whole, but I am also insisting that you can't use that phrase to permit the defendant, after having obtained a pre-filing authorization, to throw anything he wants over the transom of the judge's chambers. And the way you have to do that is by reference to Section 2244B4, which vests in the trial judge the responsibility of excising from his assessment any matters that are not properly before the court under the statute. And I would submit that what that means is he must excise anything that's not the subject of a pre-filing application here, anything that is untimely, or anything that's been properly litigated. And if the statute doesn't mean that, all of those limitations are entirely valueless.
Well, the inadmissible evidence has already been litigated. And we know that that comes in.
We know that that comes in.
So that category that you've just suggested to us, we know you're wrong.
No, you don't, because I'm talking about evidence that was inadmissible, deemed to be inadmissible at trial. That's what Schlupp talks about. It doesn't talk
about... Yeah, but see, Schlupp only goes so far. It tells us this, but it doesn't speak to this evidence that you're objecting to.
Well, Schlupp doesn't speak to it.
It doesn't suggest in any way, shape, or form.
But other sections of the statute surely do.
Why would we look at 2244? I thought this was because
Section 2255H tells you to do so, and because
it says go look at 2244.
It says
I don't think so.
It says it says you have to look at, you have to consider all the factors in 2244. But the point is...
It references 2244?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. I believe it does. I think it's in subparagraph H.
Okay.
And because
must be certified as provided in Section 2244.
And five other circuits have held that that language incorporates all the limitations in Section 2244. And the defendant doesn't concede that. That you have to read the two sections in tandem. And in addition to that, most of the problems related to this case do not fall under 2244. They squarely fall under 2255. 2255 says you've got to obtain a certificate of appealability from this court if you want to raise a claim. That was not done here. That is a jurisdictional requirement, according to Judge Wilkins, and it was not done here. This doesn't mean the defendant can't do it, but it simply was not satisfied here. And what we're asking this court to do is simply to enforce these provisions as they are written. And if you don't, I'm going to be back here again next year with the next bunch of vacuum cleaner dust arguing that they presented that they established the presence of hippies, a band of hippies, in the McDonald household. As you said earlier, at some point litigation in this case must come to an end. And the way I would suggest that it do is that you enforce this statute as it's written. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Zasitarsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the government's arguments, first, I would ask the court to plug in to Section 2244 what we have here. The facts underlying the claim, that is, that and at the 2244 gatekeeping standard, it says, if proven, so we're accepting that this happened. AUSA Blackburn told Helena Stokely, if you testify to that, I'm going to indict you for murder.
You see, I don't know that this goes anywhere one way or the other, but to me, a prosecutor would be derelict in his duty if he didn't say to a witness, if you testify inaccurately, if you perjure yourself, I'm going to try you for perjury.
But that's not the claim, Your Honor.
Well, but it's pretty close to the claim. So it doesn't strike me as this great gun that you have. But it seems to me that I really am still searching for a way to get this evidence as a whole language lined up with 2244 and 2255. And you haven't given me a very sad, it does, the way you interpret it, it's a total end run. And that can't be what Congress intended.
Your Honor, I believe that Congress intended to adopt Schlupp in that phrase.
Well, and Schlupp doesn't speak to what the evidence that's in question here, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that House versus Bell, which is based upon Schlupp, Supreme Court 2006, says in evaluating the Schlupp standard, you consider, quote, all of the evidence, old and new, incriminating and exculpatory, without regard to whether it would necessarily be admitted under rules of admissibility that govern at trial.
I think that's true. But you got a certificate of appealability on some basis, and now you want to put in some other evidence, which was not before us when we were granting the certificate of appealability. It seems to me that's the question here, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the certificate of appealability in this case says whether the district court's procedural decisions prohibiting the expansion of the record to include evidence received after trial and after filing of the 2255 was erroneous in light of 2244b2b.
So if you leave court today and you find some new evidence, you can then consider that, the district court is to consider that too? This never ends?
No, Your Honor.
You can make that position in light of 2244 and 2255?
I can't ask the district court to consider new evidence except in connection with the 2244 evaluation of our constitutional claim. That's where the government and the defense part here, is that the government keeps saying, well, we're throwing all this evidence in here and asking the court for relief. What we're throwing evidence in here is in support of the court making this 2244 gatekeeping standard of the validity of the constitutional claim. It's not a new claim. We're not seeking to have evidence relating to the hair fibers that related to the 1990 habeas as a separate habeas claim now. We're not. That's not the claim. I agree that claim is a separate thing. That's not the subject of this motion. But that evidence can be considered as part of the evidence as a whole, because what 2244 says is you take the constitutional claim and see if that would cause a jury to say the person's not guilty. Well, if there's lots of evidence of the person's innocence, necessarily the strength of your constitutional claim is not going to need to be nearly as strong. Here, obviously, we say we have DNA evidence, which is exculpatory. We have other habeas evidence, which is exculpatory. And we have an issue where this court has already said in 1980 If Elena Stokely had testified as she would expect, as she was expected to by the defense, that is, admitting presence in the McDonald home on the night of the murder, the injury to the government's case would have been incalculably great. That's what this court said on direct appeal in 1980. That's how important that is to the verdict in this case. And I think that that really plays into the key issue before this court, which is, in assessing the 2244 standard, the district court just refused to consider all these other things, which necessarily affects the consideration of the gatekeeping standard. It was considered in isolation, which we submit is error under 2244. On that basis, on the basis of the of specifically what's in the certificate of appealability, we'd submit that this court has to reverse the district court's order. I'd also add on jurisdiction that under Slack, the government's argument here is the exact argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court in Slack. In Slack, the claim was dismissed on the abuse of the writ basis, and that was the issue that went up to the Supreme Court. It was a procedural issue, obviously separate and apart from the merits. And the Supreme Court there said, no, if it's debatable, a certificate of appealability will be issued, directly rejecting the argument made by the government here. I see my time is up. We'd ask you to reverse the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.